introducing the topic for this year, which is Halacha Engages Modernity. The first week we spoke about... when the modern period began and what some of the fundamental differences were, focusing primarily on the 19th century. Last week we moved up a little bit more to the 20th century and discussed some fascinating examples. Today we're going to conclude this part of the discussion and get to the first of our topics. I want to thank Mr. Eddie Turkel for giving me a list of topics. I chose one of the many, and I'm open to additional suggestions from the floor in terms of topics that the people are interested in hearing about. So I want to thank Eddie for yet another contribution. Last week I spoke, Motzei Shabbat I believe was the 14th, if I'm not mistaken, and there was a posting on the Hirurim Musings, a blog, on the 17th. A few days later, about the rabbi as master, what we call Mora da Asra. So the rabbi is a master, it means that all matters of the town are the rabbi's responsibility. The U.S. rabbis serve congregations and not towns. Is there a idea of a religious authority to families who voluntarily join a rabbi's synagogue? Interesting. So the Ramah writes, a rabbi is not allowed to rule on ritual matters within the domain of another rabbi. Interesting. Question is, does it apply today? Answer, I hope not. For a simple reason.
In Europe it applies.
You'll hear what I'm saying in a minute. I hope not. Why do I hope not? Because I am always getting questions from people on all kinds of matters of ritual law who live all over the world. From Israel, from New Jersey, from Manhattan. And they're asking me questions because they know me from before, or maybe when they used to live here, or whatever. They went my shir, or they just know. They just call us something, maybe rabbi shopping, calling me anonymously, whatever. But I'm getting calls from all over the place. How can I answer anybody's question if they're living in a different community? So I don't know if this Rama applies nowadays. I think the answer, of course, is it depends what the nature of the ruling is. The examples that are given over here, Gemara Masechta Shabbos, where a rabbi placed under a ban, remember this, we discussed the ban in our previous shiurim, who ruled like Shmuel within the region where Rav was the authority. So Rav was the authority, and at a certain time you cannot follow the opinion of Shmuel. I believe that this applied in situations where Rav was the authority. That means you had to follow him. We gave examples of the town of Rabbi Eliezer, where they would actually cut down trees on Shabbos, preparing for a bris milah. As we had the bris today, no one cut down any trees, to the best of my knowledge, this past Friday night or this morning to make a milah knife. I would not allow it as the rov, at least in this shul. And it seems to me, therefore, that today. The concept of Mora da Asra, that what he says goes in the entire town, no longer exists, because in most towns there are numerous rabbis, and as we heard before, the rabbi within his shul has authority. That I agree with completely. But the rabbi within his shul, that authority is the authority about what happens in the shul. So therefore, if someone wants to do something in this shul, as a shul policy, against the ruling of the rabbi, I wouldn't have him excommunicate. We're not in that mode these days. But it would be incorrect. It would be inappropriate. Within a shul, the rabbi is the Mora da Asra in that shul. But if an individual has a question which has nothing to do with the shul, it's a private matter. And within the community itself, there are numerous opinions, numerous rabbonim, numerous authorities. And someone has a question, is such a thing kosher? Is such a thing permissible on Shabbos? Not for the shul, for his own private kitchen, his own private home. So I believe that a person is not bound in these areas by the position of the local rov. Now, I'm sorry.
But he has to listen to you when he gets him stopped, doesn't he?
Anyone who asks a shaila of a particular rov should be bound by the answer that he receives, irrespective of whether he's a shul rabbi, whoever he happens to be. If a question was asked, then there's an understanding that the response is binding on the questioner. Didn't have to ask the question in the first place. But it... Slow. Correct. So if we're talking about public matters, we then are getting close to the border of what's considered to be a shul matter, what's considered to be a private matter. And that border may be wide. But okay, that may be something along those lines. If a person is in a community and there is a recognized Mora D'Astra, but you understand by definition, it can't possibly be right by what you said. If the Arab exists in a town, then by definition, there's at least one rabbi who approves of it. So, tied to the Sastri. But there could be cases which are similar in that vein. Let's take a purely private matter. Tara Semeshbach. As private as you can get. And someone asks a shala by a rav who doesn't live in that town. I don't think it's a violation for the question to ask or for the rabbi to answer. In other words, there is a certain measure of rabbinic authority, but today, where the rabbi himself is joined by five other rabbis in the town, and there's almost no situation where the rav is the rav of the entire town. So by definition, the person is not bound necessarily in his private life by a position of a particular rav. I don't think the idea of rabbinic authority extends that far. So I don't agree with this sentence. In other words, outside rabbis should not be asserting their views to members of someone else's synagogue. I don't agree with that. I mean, maybe the word asserting I would agree. For me to pick up the phone and say, listen, sir, you have to listen to me. I don't say that to people in my own synagogue. I'm saying to someone else's synagogue. But if someone asks the question from a different town and asks me, what is this Lutheran Shabbos? Is this kosher? Is Taras HaMishpacha? I don't think anything wrong with that person asking. Nor is anything wrong with my answer. That's my view on this matter. And why is this in the news? Based upon something about the Israeli army. Is the Israeli soldier bound by the halakhic decisions of an army rabbi, or should he instead consult with his Rosh Hashiva, a hometown rabbi? So what was the answer that the rabbi gave? The rabbi Melamed. This is coming from something written in 2004. So it's already 5 years ago. He said, you know, there are many excellent army rabbis, but some are not so qualified, or they're too deferential to their military superiors. Therefore, catch this compromise. A soldier should follow the ruling of the army rabbi, who was the Mora D'Astra in the army camp. He is the official rabbi. Unless his decision does not make sense. In which case, the soldier should ask an outside rabbi. Now this is Rabbi Gil's student, Shalita, you know, understands that there's big problems with this. So what makes sense and what doesn't make sense is in the eyes of the beholder. He quotes a dissenter. Makes sense is so subjective. How can it be? And outside rabbis don't always understand the immediate circumstances. They're educated about training practical halakha, religious disunity within units, and officers will ignore army rabbis when they see even religious soldiers not follow their instructions. It's a disaster. So what do you do? So Rabbi's student has a compromise. This compromise itself is somewhat problematic. So like this, should ask your outside rabbi about the decision that doesn't, quote, make sense to you. If your outside rabbi, to ask a general question, rules that, well, I don't feel this way, but the other position of the local rabbi in the army base is a legitimate position within halacha. I believe he made what we call in halacha a tos b'shikul hadas. He didn't quite get the balance of halacha right. Then, Rabbi student suggests, you are bound by the local rabbi in your army camp, irrespective of the fact that your private rabbi would have given a different decision. However, if your private rabbi rules that the mistake was so egregious by the local army rabbi, as we call the Torah B'dvar Mishnah, which is completely has no basis whatsoever, then you cannot follow. And he wants to make the same analogy to synagogue members. The outside rabbi was my rabbi completely wrong, partially wrong. This is a very interesting theory, and I certainly give it a certain amount of importance. But I would have a different line I would draw. Again, it depends what the matter is. If the rabbi in the army camp rules that something is kosher, and I know from before that my rabbi said it's not kosher, didn't become kosher when I came into the army base. So just my rabbi said this is not kosher, so I just shouldn't eat it. Simple as all that. But if the army base rabbi is ruling on matters of security, you know, this is we have to do this for security reasons, that for security reasons, I believe you're bound by the army rabbi. And if you don't want to be bound by the army rabbi, you shouldn't join the army. Because everyone knows if you join the army, you're bound by the army rabbi in matters which pertain to security, as opposed to matters which pertain to your private life and kashrus, etc. Of course, the borderline is Shabbos. Because Shabbos, of course, security trumps Shabbos. But sometimes, I know when I was in Karen B'Avna, the boys would complain that some would make them do frivolous things on Shabbos, which had nothing to do with security, and in the name of security. That's where it gets a little tricky, but I'm not solving all the world's problems. I'm just using this as a segue into our taking leave of this particular part of this series to go to the particular part and see the connection between the two. And as I said before, we're starting today a new topic called assisted reproduction. And as I said before, I'm open to other suggestions for future shiurim. Now, I'm going to begin by reading to you a fascinating piece in a sefer called Nishmas Avraham. Okay? I have the Hebrew version. One can easily get the English version, which we have. As a matter of fact, if someone will give me the English version from that inside room, I'll be able to give you the page number, so you'll be able to see to what I'm referring. And this is actually, Eben HaEzer would be on. Nishmas Avraham and Eben HaEzer. Thank you. And you will see, I've given before in the past shiurim what I consider to be a very broad definition of halachic authority. Now, last week we didn't quite finish, and just before, while we're getting the other page, I quoted my Rebbe Rav Soloveitchik's position on rabbinic authority, and I explained that he extended it way beyond the Shulchan Aruch, but just as within the Shulchan Aruch there can be different opinions, so too within, beyond the Shulchan Aruch, there can be different opinions. Thank you so much. And therefore, he did not believe in any single automatically dominant opinion in real halacha, strict halacha, nor in what we'll call the broader definition of halacha. That's number one. Number two, he felt strongly, both within strict halacha and beyond, that we are rabbinic authorities should do their homework and find out the facts from experts in the field, just as rabbis consult with doctors in matters of Shabbos and Yom Kippur, so too should they consult with the relevant experts in the broader areas which relate to halacha that they're asked to give their opinions about, such as experts in the military, perhaps even in the political, when that's relevant. And number three, perhaps most importantly, he did not believe, and nor do I, in rabbinic infallibility. As a matter of fact, that very same Sefer Achinuch that we spoke about last week at the end of the shiur, where he suggested that a person is required to listen to the Atzas HaGedolim in each and every generation, which was seeming to be an endorsement of the, we'll call it, generally speaking, the Das Torah principle, there in that same piece, the Chinuch admits that the possibility of human error, rabbinic error, certainly exists. And he asks the question, why does the Torah say Lo Sasu Yamun Usmol, do not stray left or right, when after all the rabbinic authority may be mistaken? His answer is very, very powerful. Yes, he may be mistaken, but he's usually going to be right. The alternative is anarchy. And anarchy is a much worse alternative than following the rabbinic authority, even though he may be mistaken here or there. Given all those caveats, I believe that my Rebbe's position on rabbinic authority that he enunciated so forcefully in this Hesped for Reb Chaim Moshe that we spoke about last week was something he continued to believe in throughout his life, contrary to those who said he changed his mind based upon his change of political affiliation or based on the Holocaust or based on all kinds of other things. I don't think he would have had it reprinted in the 70s had he changed his mind. This is just a quick synopsis. Now I'm ready to start the segue into the assisted reproduction issue. Right. Yes?
Just back on rabbinical authority.
Sure.
In a matter of halacha, what you're allowed to do on Shabbos or something like that, even if the rabbis made a mistake, you know, like and they're wrong and they give the wrong psak, but couldn't we say the Torah says we should listen to them anyway because there is no absolute halacha? Oh, the rabbis are the one who make the halacha, so they really, by definition, can't be a terrible mistake. They're the ones who are telling us to do the halacha. We're following them. We're doing what the Torah says. But like in a matter of, if somebody says to a rabbi, should I open a candy store on this corner? And the rabbi gives him his opinion, you know, like obviously he could make a mistake. And there, you know, like, why should we listen to him?
You're right. Any rabbi who's silly enough to give an opinion as a business person, when he knows nothing about business.
But this happens every day.
So if people, you know, it's like rolling the dice. It's no worse than that. But I don't believe that rabbis should be giving business advice. And I believe that the intelligent rabbis are not giving business advice. And unless it is something which is of a broader general rule, should I take, how risk averse should I be? Things of this nature, which goes beyond the candy store. That's a matter of hashkafa, how you should look at things. That's a whole different story. And I believe strongly. I believe it was someone who was telling me at my table just over Shabbos. People came to Rav Moshe asking about some kind of a business investment, and the person was offering twice the amount of money than the bank was giving in a guaranteed fashion. And Rav Moshe responded, that's impossible. Now, people who invested with a certain man, BM, would have asked Rav Moshe his advice. They never would have invested in the first. But their Rav Moshe advice would have saved many people many billions of dollars. So sometimes Rabbanim do things, think through things more carefully because they're not somehow meshuchad. Shochad Yavin Echacham, the idea of making the money, he was a third disinterested party. He could look at it dispassionately. So there the Das Torah would have been appropriate. But again, in particulars, you have to know what on the exact thing. Now, the Sefer Nishmas Avraham talks about a remarkable phenomenon. I just spoke about it in a different context just a few, 3 days ago, and I got an interesting response, and I wanted to share it with you. In the English edition, it can be found. See? On page 19. Okay, since I was reading from the Hebrew on page Kuf Pei Aleph in volume 4. Since we have the English, I read it to you from the English. The question arose in Israel of a traditional woman, aged over 30, who had despaired of getting married but wanted to have a child. She wished to undergo artificial insemination from a donor, which is called AID, simple Rosh HaTevis, provided that he was Jewish and of pure lineage. That his identity would be known to an official government body, Ministry of Health or Religion, to avoid problems in the future of a brother marrying a sister. That the sperm would be taken from someone who, in any case, was going to donate a sperm to a sperm bank. This chatter came to Dr. Abraham. I thought, he says, that such an act would be despicable, although I did not know if there was a specific Torah prohibition once the sperm was available anyway. A logical response from Dr. Abraham. But the questioner argued that since this was being done anyway without any supervision, surely it would be better, even if despicable, that it at least be done under the controlled conditions set out by her. And what's its proof? Our next topic, the one I gave out the source for, which we'll get to hopefully soon, was Rav Nevenzahl Shlita had written in response to Tzitz Eliezer's ruling forbidding IVF as a procedure for infertile couples. Verbatim. Rav Nevenzahl said that one does not need to fear about future problems since the procedure IVF would bring, since in any case, not everyone knows Eis Halacha, and the problems will arise anyway. Meanwhile, the happiness of a couple is in the balance. So wrote Rav Nevenzahl. So the questioner to Dr. Abraham said the same thing should apply in this case. However, it seemed to me, Dr. Abraham writes, that there was nevertheless a difference between the two situations. The problem of IVF should indeed be considered against the problem of keeping a marriage intact, as Rav Nevenzahl Shlita says. In the question under discussion, however, we have only the desire of an unmarried woman to become a mother in a way that is not that of the daughters of Israel, True, this cannot be prevented. But who says that one may help her to do so, even if the purpose of the registration is to prevent future problems? Question mark. Is the question clear? Very clear question. And what's happening in Israel is happening in America too. For those who know, no. Rav Auerbach Zatzal, Shlomo Zalman, agree with me. Writing, the verse says, remove from yourself distortion of the mouth and keep a twisting of lips at a distance. That is, do not make yourself an object of gossip and suspicion. And she, by this act, brings upon herself a suspicion of harlotry. Besides, the child will have difficulties in the future, and who knows if this will not cause him much sorrow, etc., etc. So, Shlomo Zalman Paskin, no, it's prohibited. I was once asked to speak about this. I would say it goes back, I'm trying to guess, I think it's close to 7 years ago, for the Association of Orthodox Jewish Scientists, who had their convention. I remember it was in the Fifth Avenue Synagogue. I believe it was even dedicated to the memory of Lord Jacobowitz. I think he may have been shortly after his Petit, I don't exactly. Right. He was officially the rabbi in Fifth Avenue a long time ago. I think it was, if my years are right, it was about the time of a little after his Petira. And I was asked the same question myself. And I also felt it was wrong. I quoted this segment as a source. And I said, I think it's not right. And my main reason was, that from the Torah perspective, children are to be brought into a Jewish family. Children not to be brought into a vacuum when there is no Jewish family, by a single mother. Now, years have gone by, and the question has come up, and you will see in a moment how it relates to rabbinic authority. You'll ask, what could be further from rabbinic authority than this? What a woman does in the privacy of her laboratory, right, is what's to do with the rabbi. So I'll tell you what came up in two sequential cases, one after the other. First was a case of a, forgive the expression, it'll take me too long to describe without using the modern parlance, a lesbian couple. I'm not giving any credence to this expression, just using it to save time. A quote, lesbian couple that decided to have a child. Okay, so they had a child. I have to assume it came through AID. I know about biology, that's where it had to have come from. I'm assuming that no one did anything wrong in the sense of illicit relationships. Okay. So they did what they did. What's it to do with the rabbi? They want to come to the shul and make a bris with all the requisite honors. And we had a bris in shul today, a wonderful bris with speeches and a suda and mishaberachs. They wanted the whole nine yards for this child, who was a Jewish child, and required a bris, no doubt about it. But they wanted the rabbi, in effect, to put his stamp on it. And the rabbi said, no. That is rabbinic authority. The rabbi in his shul is the authority. Yes?
Why do you have to go to such an outrageous case? That, in other words, the rabbi could say, I don't like this family for a different reason or another, you know, like, if the rabbi could say...
Then he'll probably be fired.
Because...
the rabbi, I don't like this family, can't make a bris.
You see, she's presenting a Jewish child of 8 days, she says requires a bris.
Good.
Now you're saying the rabbi should go back to her, to where this child came from.
I happen to agree.
Okay, but now, let's say...
I'm going further.
Not Jewish or something, I don't know.
All right, let's say your husband's not Jewish. Exactly, that's another case. But let's take even a less egregious case, the case we started with. The woman has no lesbian partner. The woman is completely by herself. But she's getting older, her clock is ticking down, she wants to have a child, and she does what Rabbi Shlomo Zalman Auerbach said shouldn't be done. She went to a sperm bank and became pregnant, and is... has a boy, wants a bris in the shul. Once again, the rabbi said no. Why? Presumably, he felt this was not something that she's willing to put his rabbinical stamp of approval on, and therefore, he's not saying it shouldn't be a bris. A male should go and do a bris on the eighth day. Fine. But now with the institutional approval, which goes together with a kind of a public bris in the shul. Now, when I said this just a few days ago, I decided to quote a source, my own source, not a source found in Nishmas Avraham. I'd like everybody to please open. I asked to give out a chumashim. Everyone should please take a chumash in Rashi. I see 25 of them there on that shelf. Please, everyone should take one or look on with your neighbor. And I'm opening to the very beginning of the chumash. The very beginning of the chumash. Parshas Bereishis. Perek Beis. All right, we're in the second perek, not the first. Pasuk Chav Dalet. Perek Beis, Pasuk Chav Dalet. A very famous pasuk. Everybody knows the pasuk, or should know the pasuk. As the Torah HaKadosha. Al Kain, Yaz of Ish, Es Ovi, V'es Imo, V'dovak B'yishto. Therefore, every man shall leave his father and his mother and cleave unto his wife. V'hayu levasar echad, says Rashi. Levasar echad. Havlad notzar ayedei shenehem. The child is born through the two of them. V'sham naseh b'saram echad. Then they become united as one, where the genes, if you will, meet. And in the creation, and the conception, and the birth of this child. So I said, what the Torah HaKadosh is telling us is precisely that in the Torah's view of the world, a person leaves a father and a mother, cleaves unto a wife, and in this context, has a child. Now the Torah HaKadosh, written by HaKadosh Baruch Hu knew the future, and he even knew about IVF at that time. But it was given to human beings. Let's say IVF was off their radar screen at the time. But they certainly knew of the possibility of children being born having nothing to do with marriage. This did not start in the 21st century, ladies and gentlemen. Nonetheless, the Torah wishes that children should be born in the context of marriage. I want to go a step further. If you look carefully, a few psukim earlier, Pasuk Yud Ches, another very famous pasuk, Vayomer Hashem Elokim, Lo Tov Heyo Sa'odam Levado, Es Eloeze Kenegdo. It's not good for man to be alone, I will create for him a helpmeet, the wife. Asks the Ravid, Lo Tov? Lo Tov means, you know, it's not so great. Not so great. If Adam would be created without Eve, we'd be extinct. There would be no human race. Lo Tov sounds like a gross understatement. Answers the Ravid in his introduction to the Bali HaNefesh. All this means is, for this reason, Hashem did not create man and woman the same way as he created all of the other animals. All of the other animals that we read back in the first parak were created a male and a female, totally separately. Man was created as one and then divided, however you explain it, but there was some kind of a division subsequently. Why? Explains the Ravid. Because animals were created separately, they live separately. What does that mean? The animals mate, the male and the female. And then the father runs off, never to be seen again. There's no family unit. Because Hashem wished that there be a family unit, Lo Tov Heyo Sa'odam Levada, without a wife. Oh, Hashem could have made man and woman the same as the lions and the tigers. They could have procreated the same as the lions and the tigers do. There'd be no family unit. That would be not the extinction of mankind, but it would be Lo Tov. Which again, if this interpretation is correct, the Kodesh Baruch Hu was saying and creating things differently from the very beginning, so that there be a family unit into which the children will be born and children will be raised. And this is a very, very important fundamental principle of the world, going back to the very creation. So I said this at a shir, and after the shir was over, a woman comes over to me and says to me, that thing that you said, is that a halacha? Well, that's just, you know, some pure speculation. I said, if you ask me, I have a very broad definition of halacha. You've already heard the last 2 weeks. Yes, this is a halacha. It's based upon a pasuk. It's based upon a Rashi. This is based upon a pasuk. Based upon a Ravid. These are traditional authorities from, yes, 800 years ago. And we try to follow in their footsteps and interpret to the best of our ability, based on what these giants said. Do I admit that the other rabbis can disagree with me? Absolutely. They can disagree with me about the Eruv, and about the water, and about Taras HaMishpacha, everything this week, I have no problem, but I feel that a Rav is entitled to an opinion on these matters. He cannot govern the private lives of individuals, not in his own shul, and so not beyond the shul, in the community, not even beyond the community for sure, but he can make certain policies that reflect what he considers to be the appropriate way to deal with these issues. This is the halacha, that when HaKadosh Baruch Hu, it says in the Torah, the first law. What I said, that that the Torah does not approve of this idea of a single woman.
So therefore, she can't have the bris in the shul.
If you ask me, in this young Israel Riverdale, she would not have the bris.
She adopted a child.
That might be different. I would not encourage a single woman to adopt a child.
How about the Gemara talks about a woman who is impregnated in Ambatia. I don't know what that means, but let's say it's true. So she comes with her child. Is she allowed to have a bris?
Okay. Very simple. If it were possible for a woman to become impregnated in an abacha, just went to the swimming pool and became pregnant, if that could be demonstrated, well, then that's, we might call a fluke, not going to be repeated. So if the rabbi approves of that bris, it's not going to happen again. So that's the difference in this situation. Allowing this bris is leading to the breakdown of the Jewish family. I hope you understand where I'm coming from. I'm not trying to say it so strongly. We believe in family values. And if you don't draw a line here, they'll break down faster than you think. So that's why when rabbis draw a line here, you think they should be taking a few steps back. No. They choose their lines. That people choose different lines in different places. And every rabbi has the right to choose his line where he so wishes. I'm not taking away the right of any rav to disagree with me forcefully, vehemently, completely. The same as they can disagree with me in a pshat, in a Mishnah Berurah. Fine. As I said in my introduction, we believe in a multiplicity of possible views. But this does not mean that a rabbi has to be silent just because someone will disagree with him. Fine, there's room for disagreement on these matters, as in any other matter. Okay, now in the last part of the shiur, I want to discuss the first specific topic within assisted reproduction, for which I also hope you'll be able to utilize the Chumash and Rashi that you have in front of you. And in particular, we're going to begin with this week's parsha. Coming week's parsha. This is, you can't top that. The Rav speaks on the parsha of the week coming up. This is fantastic. So we're going to look over here in Perek Choftes. Wait a minute. No, it's Perek Lamed, I believe. Perek Lamed. Pasuk Chof Aleph. Pasuk Chof Aleph. Perek Lamed Pasuk Chof Aleph says, the acha yoldo bas vatikro es shema Dina. Okay? So Leah gave birth to a daughter, and her name was Dina. The next pasuk, the very next pasuk. Vayizkor Elokim es Rochel, vayishma Leah Elokim, vayiftach es Rachma, vatara teled bein, vatomer osaf Elokim es Cherposi, vatikro shvo Yosef lemor, Yosef Hashem li ben acher. So we read together four psukim in Chumash Bereishis. Let's see what Rashi has to say. Rashi on Pasuk Chof Aleph. Dina. Pirshu Rabbi Oseinu. Shedono leo din biatzma. Im ze zochor. If it is a male. Lo te rochel achosi ki achas hashfachos. She will have, won't even have the two sons that the maidservants had, Bilhah and Zilpah. V'hispalala alav, and she prayed over this male fetus that was in her uterus. V'ne'apach l'nekeva. This is not, again, if you can pull this off, you can have as many bris or no bris you want. Anyone can pull this off, it's not going to be repeated. This is what the Gemara tells us. I saw somebody was wise enough to pull out a chumash mikros gadolos. Someone have that? I just saw someone. Can I borrow that? And what, Mr. Redder, you're a smart man. And while you're doing that, if someone can go, maybe someone can get me a Marzer for Rosh Hashanah, if you don't mind. We have upstairs a Marzer for Rosh Hashanah. To get me the article, it'd be better. I'll be able to read the translation for you. So, thank you. So according to the pshat that Rashi has, what happened was that the embryo, a male embryo in the womb of Leah, miraculously became a female. And in this manner, we know there's a zero-sum game. It had to be 12 boys. That everybody knew in advance, right? Because, you know, Yehuda, because she got more than her share. Everyone knows that they all knew it was going to be 12. So therefore, this enabled the Ashkacha to see to it that Rachel would also have two children. Fine. Now, this is the interpretation based upon Rashi. And the Gemara in Bracha seems to agree with this interpretation. Let me read you the Targum, Yonason ben Uziel. Ushmiya men kodam Hashem tzelusa de Leah. And God listened to the prayers of Leah, who didn't want her sister Rachel to be embarrassed. Catch this now. V'ischalfu ubraya bim ehon. Look, once it's a miracle, what's the difference how big the miracle is? There was an exchange of embryos from one sister to another. The male embryo that was in the womb of Leah moved to the womb of Rachel, and vice versa. V'avayahiv Yosef b'moha de Rachel, v'dina b'moha de Leah. This sounds quite astounding. Quite astounding. But, thank you. By a show of hands, who never heard of this pshat until right now? Raise your hand. Good. So next year, when you come to Shul and Rosh Hashanah, I'm sure everyone, I hope I will be, Mr. Shul, we should all be gesund. Everyone should come to Shul and Rosh Hashanah. And you, on the first day, of Rosh Hashanah, and you will be hearing in the first day of Rosh Hashanah, at the beginning of the Chazara Sashatz, there are three consecutive piyutim, all written by Rav Lezer HaKalir, about the various avos, about Avram, about Yitzchak, and about Yaakov. Catch this now. You all said it. You did. I mean, I assume you did. It wasn't the shul. Well, I don't know. Shachris. Rosh Hashanah, maybe not all the women were there on time, maybe. Maybe they were, I don't know. But the men, I hope, this is already in Chazara, so Shatz had to have been in their seats. When we got in the article, sit at the page 312. We're discussing now about Rachel. Zochar lo yosher orachos. What does that mean? God remembered the propriety of her ways. Ubar lo hamir bebeten achos. Everything rhymes amazingly. And change the embryo in her sister's womb. Chushva kehayom zichro leheachos. On this day, her memory was deemed worthy to become her sister's equal. Siluf dina bihosef lahanchos. To appease her by exchanging dina for Yosef. Black on white in the mavza. People have been saying it for 50 years. I don't know how many years people have been saying it. And here it is. And it follows the version in the Yerushalmi Brachos and Bereshis Rabbah, and we saw it in the Targum as well, that Joseph had been an embryo in Leah's womb while Dina was in Rachel's, but God exchanged the two for Rachel's sake. See also a commercial. Art Scroll, Bereshis 30:21. Commercial. There's nothing wrong with that. So this is what it says. Now, fascinatingly, it's hard to derive rigorous halacha from Midrashim, but I want to give you one more fascinating issue. This is obviously going to relate to our specific question we're going to be discussing, the IVF and who was the mother. Before I show you the next Rashi, let's just spell it out. There is now a concept known as IVF from a donor egg, for those who may not know exactly what the details are. A woman does not have viable eggs, ova. Doesn't work. She cannot have a child. Otherwise, the rest of the body is in great shape. She can produce many, many children, but just lacks the eggs. So you procure a donor egg, the zera of the husband and the donor egg are mixed in a laboratory, inserted into a womb, presto, out comes a baby. Now, we said before of Neventhal as opposed to IVF, he was even opposed to IVF if it was only the parents' genes that were involved. It can be cases in which the woman has eggs, but cannot conceive naturally. There's a blockage somewhere. So you can take the husband's zera, the wife's egg, put them together, and have IVF. Many of us know people who were born that way. Yeah. So he says, oppose that. He opposed it. Rav Neventhal was in favor of it. That's what we spoke about before. And I said it backwards. Oh, I'm sorry. Excuse me. So this is something which is done. And by the way, I was just at a Shalom Zohar last night. We had a discussion about C-sections and the fact that a C-section, if it happens, the Mila is not done on Shabbos. One of our Mespalim, fortunately, found it in the Shulchan Aruch before making the mistake of having his son Gris on Shabbos when his son had been born via C-section. A much less known thing, which is quite controversial, is what about an IVF baby born on Shabbos? Is it Bris Docha Shabbos or not? Not a simple matter. Because the reason is very simple. It says in the Torah, well, let's look it up. Once you have a Chumash and Rashi in front of you, so we can just look. Please turn to Sefer Vayikra. Perek Yud Beis. We'll just do two psukim, Beis and Gimel. It says in Pasuk Beis, the beginning of Parshas Tazria, Daberel b'nei Yisrael emor, Ishoki Sazria v'yolda zohar, V'tomo shivas yamim, Kimenidas devosotit. The ritual impurity that exists with respect to a woman who is, quote, Kisazria v'yolda zohar. The next Pasuk says, U'vayom ha'shmini yimol b'sar oloso. So the Gemara in Shabbos tells us that these two go together. If the woman has what's called Tumas Leda, then the bris pushes off the Shabbos. Otherwise not. If it's a C-section, it's a whole dispute. We assume it is. There's no Tumas Leda, and therefore the bris would not be Docha Shabbos. What about IVF? What about artificial insemination for that matter? It's the same question. So there is.
And there's also no Bechora.
Well, I'm not going there right now. Let's just talk about Shabbos. Slowly. So there's a dispute about this very point. It's based upon a review going back 1,000 years. Rabbeinu Gershom, Rabbeinu Chananel, one of the Gedolim that's printed on the side of the Gemara, Chagiga, Tainus, in some place that most people don't know, where it's suggested that this famous Nizra Bambati case, which was theoretical in those days, which is practical today, there is no Tumas Leda, would not be Docha Shabbos. If I know about a bris, that it's an IVF, or artificial insemination, let's say from the husband, AIH, AID, the same thing, I would tell the person the bris should be postponed till Sunday. But Rabbi, how do I do this? The whole world's going to know. No problem. The baby is yellow. The baby is yellow. If the baby is yellow, you can't have a bris. You have to wait 7 days. It's actually been done. Now, there are very great rabbis who disagree on this point and say, doesn't matter. That's only if it happened by a fluke. If it's done in the lab or premeditatedly, it is Docha Shabbos. You know, the great halachic minds of today can disagree on a very weighty matter. And both positions have validity. Since I'm always conservative, I say, don't take a chance. Wait till after Shabbos. Yeah, if I know about it. If it happened already, it happened. Yes?
This is, let's say you were the rabbi at Yosef HaTzadik's bris. Now, based on this medrash, which you knew about, would you say that he would postpone his bris, or do we say that halachically that story has no validity? And that would be, because I was saying about Bechora, because Yosef might not be a Bechor because of that. That whole thing. And that
so let's now turn back. Very good, Eddie. Excellent. Let's turn back No, so here's the question. Here we have an unusual case, assuming the Yosef case and the Dina case to be accepted as such. The question is, doesn't this indicate that the birth mother is the mother? After all, Rachel was the birth mother of Yosef. And we all know that Yosef is the son of Rachel, as it was described throughout the Chumash. So we see from here that the birth mother determines, and not the, if you will, the genetic mother. That's what it comes out. This is relevant in two directions. Two directions. That means, if there is a case of a donor egg IVF, let's say, just give the most extreme case, the donor is not Jewish. Would that child need a conversion at first glance? No! Because since the birth mother...
The donor of the egg.
So since the mother always determines, at the end of the day, the mother wins, no matter what. Who's the mother? So if we say that the mother is the birth mother, so the birth mother who carried for 9 months and gave birth to the baby is Jewish, so by definition, the child is Jewish, despite the fact that the donor of the egg is not Jewish. Yes, Danny? You're correct. But in today's world, except for the purpose of marrying a Kohen, which is very important, you're right, it doesn't matter, because even if the father is not Jewish, and as long as the mother is Jewish, the child is a kosher Jewish child. We don't have those restrictions of Amon, and we just don't have anymore, since Sancheirav mixed up the whole world. Let me go further. There's something which is called surrogacy. Everyone knows what that means? Surrogacy is exactly the flip side. That's a major problem, although amazingly, this is not really the topic for now, amazingly, Rav Moshe is a tshuva. Rav Moshe was a famous author of the tshuva, which we're not going to be discussing this minute, that if a woman is married to Reuven, and Reuven can have no children, she's unfortunately cannot, and she has artificial insemination from Shimon, Jew, that the child is kosher. Right. Satmar Rebbe went ballistic, but I mean ballistic with a capital B. Right. That the child is a mamzer, the woman has been violated, the Aseres HaDibros, he went the whole nine yards. And those who know the history, Rav Moshe suffered personally, not from the Satmar Rebbe, Chas V'Shalom, from some of his followers, who took drastic steps against Rav Moshe. Drastic. I mean, not acceptable at all. Those who know the history, it's a long time ago. Let's not go there right now. Rav Moshe went a step further. Rav Moshe said that if a man is a mamzer himself, he's already a mamzer, because unfortunately his mother was married to someone else and then lived with another man, whatever. Even he, according to Rav Moshe, a much bigger chiddush, should he have a child through artificial insemination, that child is kosher. That's mind-boggling. You understand why that's a much bigger chiddush? Because in that case, even though it started off, the first case, there were no mamzer to begin with. You wouldn't want to create it, so you don't create it. Here it already was, and it somehow stops, because it's not passed down through a normal matter of procreation. Exactly, a very new way. Exactly. It works. Okay, but that's not for this minute.
So it's the mamzer, the father who's a mamzer, you use his zera to inseminate his wife.
Right.
And the result of a child
is kosher. Now he's not. The problem is he's not allowed to marry anybody. But there's an answer to that. What's the answer? The question is, a mamzer is not permitted to marry. How do we solve the problem?
No.
A mamzer is permitted to marry a convert. A Gioris. So a mamzer marries a Gioris. On about the 10th date, he says, by the way, if you want to have children, it's going to have to be through artificial insemination. What's something wrong with you? No, I'm fine. But I read a Shuvah Rav Moshe that if you want to have a child, your child should be kosher, it's going to come in a funny way. All right? Now listen, stranger shidduchim have happened. So this is something quite remarkable. Anyway, let's go back, because I got sidetracked by your very important question. So surrogacy is exactly the opposite of donor IVF. Here's a woman who has perfectly good eggs, and she keeps conceiving, and it keeps miscarrying. One, another, I can't, they can go crazy. And they just come to a conclusion, the only way they ever have a child is to find a surrogate mother. They can't find a Jewish one. They find a non-Jewish one. Here the non-Jewish surrogate mother carries the baby for 9 months, and, Baruch Hashem, a baby is born. Now what do you do? Is this child Jewish or not Jewish? At first glance, is the flip side of the other question. One of these babies is Jewish and one is not. We just don't know who's who. Who is who? What we don't know, so we just don't know.
I asked you that question once. Was it a risk for a child like that?
Right.
And I asked you.
Right.
What is it, the Gerus or is it the they told you that the Moral has in mind.
In either way, the Moral has in mind that it should be a bris just in case for the purpose of Gerus. An oven. So we have a very male opinion that the fetus is carried in an oven. You mean like an incubator? So you really mean to say, okay.
He just doesn't know.
an incubator for 9 months. And your opinion is it should follow genetics. Both directions. Right? That means according to your position, if the non-Jewish woman is the surrogate, then the child is Jewish, coming from a Jewish egg. Other way around. If the Jewish mother carried the baby, but there's a non-Jewish donor egg, it should be not Jewish. That's your position. What? Say it again.
In the first case, a completely Jewish pair, where the mother can't carry,
right.
So they find a non-Jewish surrogate.
Right. No, the father's Jewish. Father's always going to be Jewish. Father's always Jewish. Leave out the father. Father's no problem. Father's always Jewish. I'm only discussing a Jewish father, okay? The father is Jewish in all cases. Father's always Jewish. That's not the issue. No. Let's review one more time. One more time after review. Review again. There are two opposite cases. In one, Baruch Hashem, in a normal case, the father's Jewish, the mother's Jewish, they have a baby naturally, Baruch Hashem. Next down, the father's Jewish, the mother's Jewish. There's some blockage somewhere, so they have a child with the father's zera and the mother's egg, and it comes to a lip. That's also 100% Jewish. Are you allowed to do that? Almost all poskim say absolutely yes. Almost without exception. Fine. Then it gets a little bit dicey, where the woman has one of two problems. Either a problem is she has eggs which don't work, or the problem is she can't carry. Either way, there's nothing going to happen unless you get someone else to help out. If her eggs aren't working, she gets a donor egg from a non-Jew, and she, the Jewish woman, carries for 9 months. The other case, what? Oh, so Danny agreed. So we're now on
the fourth case.
Right, so now, so you're consistent. So Mr. Redder feels genetics. Genetics, okay, fine. But at first glance, Mr. Redder, what you're saying is against this Targum. We say every Rosh Hashanah in the Mavzer. Why? Let's get it again, why? See, after all, according to this understanding, it's remarkable that Yosef and Dina were flipped from one womb to the other, yet Yosef is known as the child of Rachel, even though the genetic mother was whom?
Leah.
And Dina is known as the daughter of Leah, even though the genetic mother is whom? Rachel. Patience. Number one, it's hard to derive anything with finality from Agodos. But let's go further. Let's go to one more source. Again, you have Chumash and Rashi. Whoa, hold on. One more source. Let's take a look. In Bereshis Perek Memvav, Pasuk Yud. Bereshis Perek Memvav, our final source. Perek Memvav, Pasuk Yud. Everyone look inside and see. Uvenei Shimon. And the children of Shimon. We're going through the 70 children of Yaakov Avinu. Uvenei Shimon. Yemuel, the Yomin, the Ohad, the Yochin, the Tzocha. So far, nothing special. Vishol ben Haknanis. What does that mean? Shaul ben Haknanis. Says Rashi. We have Chumash and Rashi. Ben Haknanis. Ben Dina. Huh? Shimon married Dina? A brother married a sister? That wasn't allowed from the time of Gan Eden. This is before Matan Torah wasn't allowed. And why did it happen? Shenivala leknani. What happened? Kshahargu es Shechem lohoisa Dina rotza lotes. She refused to leave because she was so humiliated. At shenishbala Shimon sheyisa'en. Shimon promised, swore to marry her, and they had this child, Shaul ben Haknanis. How in heaven's name did Shimon marry Dina? Now, if you go with the Targum, then although ostensibly Shimon and Leah came from the same father and the same mother, because Leah is the one who actually gave birth to Dina, however, if the Targum is correct, then what? Dina is really, from the strict halakhic perspective, viewed as what? As the child of Rachel. They have the same genetic, the same father and different mother. And the laws of B'nai Noach, before the Torah was given, such a union is permissible. So when we start talking about Agados, you never know which way it's going to take you. It's right. You're right. Goes against many of the simple interpretations. I'm not picking any poison. I'm just telling you, this is what might emerge. It's clear that one cannot derive firm halachos from agadic material, but nonetheless we see that halacha has what to say on these matters, and we're going to see, this can be an introduction for a minute now, and I'll give you a homework assignment. I gave out source sheets, for those who didn't get, they're on the chair. I don't have to go past my time. The source sheets are coming from two separate Talmudic passages. I made sure to give it in English. Both from Masechta Yevamos. Both Masechta Yevamos. There is one source, which is the left column and the note on the bottom. This is, we'll call it Yevamos Tzadiches, 98. And there is another source, which is the top three pieces. You can see that the footnotes match. When I did it, I cut and pasted. One source is not exactly straight, forgive me. But it's more or less, it's certainly legible. From Yevamos 78a. So you have 98a and 78a. Yevamos Tzadiches and Ayinches. And somehow, perhaps we can glean from these sources the definition of motherhood. For one who wants to see a fantastic article about it, Contemporary Halachic Problems, Volume 4, by Rabbi Bleich. He's a master, and it comes to these things especially. There's a whole piece about this very serious question. And he discusses it. In vitro fertilization, maternal identity, or maternal identity and conversion. This article spans 36 pages. I don't want to give a 36 page assignment. But those who want to look a very well-reasoned and well-presented article in the English language can feel free to look it up. He does quote these sources in his analysis, comes to a particular conclusion. I happen to come to a different conclusion. But that's the greatness of our Torah. Halacha engages modernity. We try to bring sources to bear, not merely from the agadic source book, which is fascinating, riveting, if I may add, but we try to go to more rigorous sources, which come from the Talmud and the Rishonim, such as Rashi. On the bottom they quote Rashi. Rashi is very critical in our analysis. So, Belin Eder, you take these home. Whoever takes it home has to promise to bring it back, because otherwise, look at it for a week. If you have any suggestions during the week of which way you think these sources lead, let me know. Someone wants to borrow this for the week, I'm happy to lend it out. But again, you have to bring it back for next Moshe Shabbos. And we'll try to proceed further and analyze this very, very important problem. I'll end with a story. One story, it's like the end with stories. A while ago, I cannot say precisely when it was, I was involved in two cases of this sort. The two flip cases. There was a case of an individual, neither came from Riverdale. So, you know, I'm not giving away any, I'm not saying where they're from, no one's from Riverdale. In one case, it was an IVF, and the IVF was a donor egg of non-Jewish origin. They were told it's better to use non-Jewish origin because this way a brother can't marry a sister. As we'll get to talk about that a little bit next week as well. That's one case I was dealing with. At the same time, I was dealing with a surrogacy case. Remarkable. Surrogacy case. And both cases came to the mikveh, not the same day, but one shortly after the other. And with some of the participants in the geiris, these little children, ger katan, were at both. I said to them, these conversions, presumably, one is required and one is not required. But I'm not sure which is which. And until the Mashiach comes, I don't think anyone's going to be absolutely sure which one is which. Shavuot Tov. That's correct. Over an hour? Maybe an hour and a minute. I'll try to go under an hour.
Thank you.